Chapter 11. The Future of Humanity. The early nuclear scientists understood both the creative and destructive potential of their work. The splitting of the atomic bomb has changed everything, save our mode of thinking, Einstein wrote after the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the Cold War began, and thus we drift toward an unparalleled catastrophe. Just as nuclear power could help us build a better future, nuclear weapons could destroy us. American post-war leaders also recognized this dual promise and peril of nuclear power. Even though the United States had a monopoly on atomic weapons at the end of the war, some American officials argued the U.S. should share its nuclear secrets with the Soviets to prevent a dangerous arms race. Others, like State Department strategy guru George Kennan, believed the United States should leverage its atomic monopoly to resist Soviet aggression. After a U.S. proposal for international control over nuclear materials, global inspections of all nuclear sites around the world, and the active sharing of atomic energy technologies for peaceful means was rejected by the Soviets, the USSR tested its first atomic device in August 1949. The nuclear arms race was on. The British detonated their first nuclear weapon 3 years later in 1952, the French in 1960, and the Chinese in 1964. Our world was fast becoming a much more dangerous place. Global efforts to balance the legitimate desire for nuclear energy with the existential danger of an unbounded nuclear arms race took a small step forward with negotiations in the 1960s to establish a nuclear arms treaty. Ratified in 1970, the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, or NPT, did two critical things. First, it established standards for non-proliferation in the five countries by then permitted to possess nuclear weapons: Britain, China, France, the United States, and the USSR. Second, it created a set of incentives to encourage other states to refrain from developing or acquiring nuclear weapons in exchange for a promise to help them develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. Since ratification, the NPT's impact has been imperfect at best. On the positive side, the world hasn't seen the nuclear arms free-for-all many feared. The acquisition of nuclear weapons by non-nuclear states also remains an important, if weakening, taboo protecting humanity. On the other hand, the United States and Russia today have the nuclear weapons to blow up the planet many times over. Both Ukraine and Libya were invaded after giving up their nuclear weapons programs. Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea have acquired nukes outside the NPT, and the danger of a global nuclear arms breakout is real and growing. It's not difficult to imagine a regime for nuclear arms reduction that might have worked better. But we're all still much better off, even with the flawed system we have. When I started thinking many years ago about how the worst dangers of the genetics revolution might be prevented, I kept coming back to the nuclear arms example. Like the nuclear arms race, an international competition in the field of genetics, a genetic arms race, has enormous potential to either improve people's lives or do them harm. Both represent technological capabilities developed in more advanced countries that become desirable and ultimately accessible the world over. Having nuclear weapons in one country may empower that country, but having nuclear weapons at all or in multiple countries threatens us all. Likewise, human genetic engineering has the potential to significantly help individual humans and countries, but an uncontrolled genetic arms race could harm humanity. At first blush, the idea of regulating the miraculous genetic technologies that researchers around the world developed with the most noble intentions feels somehow wrong. The nuclear era began at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The worst case was realized before the benefits became apparent. The genetic era is beginning in research labs, with scientists finding cures for our most debilitating diseases and IVF clinics helping loving parents make healthy children. The dangers of human genetic engineering remain more hypothetical and in the future. But as tempting as it may seem to some libertarians and transhumanists to keep governments out of science's way in these benign early days of the genetics revolution, that is not the right approach. It will simply be too dangerous for everyone if some of us start remaking the biological code of life on Earth without any common rules of the road. This will become even more the case as access to the genetic revolution's most powerful tools are democratized. Most of the NPT signatory states gave up the right to possess nuclear weapons in exchange for help developing their civilian nuclear industries because they recognized that a world where every country had nuclear weapons would be an inherently more dangerous world. If we followed the same model for human genetic engineering, countries would need to feel they were giving up the possibility of using unlimited and unrestrained gene editing on humans in exchange for assurances their countries and the world at large would be better off by developing these technologies for the common good. This may sound like a simple proposition, but it is not, particularly because, as we've seen, the aims of different people, groups, and countries are so diverse. Like with the nuclear revolution, the early pioneers of the genetic revolution are professors and researchers at important institutions. A few have already or will soon win Nobel Prizes. The people applying their work will be well-trained local doctors and technicians in IVF clinics and university, hospital, and corporate laboratories and clinics around the world. Someday in the not-distant future, however, the next generation of today's do-it-yourself or DIY biohackers, people doing biological work outside of professional laboratories, will be able to make meaningful alterations to living organisms, including future humans, on their own. The biohacking movement is exploding around the world. In a 2005 Wired article, scientist Rob Carlson outlined how he built a powerful genetic engineering lab in his garage, spending under $1,000 on eBay. Carlson wasn't birthing a genetically altered Frankenstein or giving his dog sonar, but foreshadowing our decentralized world to come. Today, there are more than 50 DIY bio community spaces in the United States, 60 in Europe, 22 in Asia, 12 in Canada, 16 in Latin America, 4 in Australia and New Zealand, and a few in Africa. Biohackers are largely unregulated and deploying increasingly powerful technologies, and they will, over time, significantly decentralize the ways and places where the genetic engineering of life happens. In these still early days, some of the biohacker applications, like the use of genome sequencing to determine whose dog is responsible for the poop on your lawn, are amusing. Others, like making cheap batches of homebrew synthetic insulin, are potentially more useful. Soon, however, DIY biologists will have access to almost unimaginably powerful and inexpensive tools, like desktop genome printers that can combine easily acquired genetic fragments to recreate life. As this happens, these DIY biohackers will become to the scientific establishment what home computer hobbyists like Steve Wozniak ended up being to the established mainframe computer companies like IBM, seemingly irrelevant outsiders who proved a heck of a lot more significant than they first appeared. As more and different types of people have access to advanced genetic enhancement capabilities, the potential upside benefit of greater innovation and the downside risk of abuse will both grow. More people using increasingly powerful technologies to solve more complicated problems will lead to greater innovation, which will expand the capacity of genetic engineering to enhance our lives faster than most of us can imagine. The most remarkable fact about human genetic engineering today, Siddhartha Mukherjee writes, is not how far out of reach it is, but how perilously, tantalizingly near. At the same time, this proliferation of knowledge and capability will bring real dangers. In addition to the possibilities for international conflict stemming from the uneven application of genetic technologies, gene editing could be used by states, terrorist groups, or individuals to create deadly pathogens with the potential to kill millions. Recently, for example, a team of researchers at Canada's University of Alberta for around $100,000 recreated from DNA fragments the horsepox virus, a dangerous relative of smallpox, in an effort to develop a vaccine to a related modern disease. Doing something like this would have been unimaginable or prohibitively expensive just a decade ago, but now the technology is not a big deal, and the costs are dropping precipitously. These changes have the potential to bring a whole new set of actors into the genetic engineering world, and with them, both new opportunities and dangers. Just like responsible scientists are weighing options for using targeted gene drives to push genetic changes through animal populations to do things like eliminate Lyme disease and malaria, rogue states, terrorists, or even well-intentioned scientists now have the ability to introduce just a small number of genetically altered organisms that could crash entire ecosystems. Recognizing this type of danger, the U.S. intelligence community, for the first time, included gene editing as a potential weapon of mass destruction threat in its 2016 Worldwide Threat Assessment. James Clapper, then U.S. Director of National Intelligence, wrote, "Research in genome editing conducted by countries with different regulatory or ethical standards than those of Western countries probably increases the risk of the creation of potentially harmful biological agents or products. Given the broad distribution, low cost, and accelerated pace of development of this dual-use technology, its deliberate or unintentional misuse might lead to far-reaching economic and national security implications." As Clapper recognized, maliciously or inadvertently deployed technologies have the potential to cause tremendous damage. The very nature of life and how people love and hate, the U.S. National Intelligence Council wrote in its 2017 Global Trends Report, is likely to be challenged by major technological advances in understanding and efforts to manipulate human anatomy, which will spark strong divisions between people, country, and regions. In June 2018, the U.S. National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine released a high-level report, Biodefense in the Age of Synthetic Biology, warning that inexpensive and accessible new synthetic tools could be used by terrorists to create deadly and potentially fast-spreading pathogens. We already heard how different countries have different national approaches toward regulating, or in some cases not regulating, genetic engineering technologies. No matter how well individual countries regulate themselves, addressing the potential dangers of the misuse of genetic technologies will also require meaningful regulation on an international level. But if creating national restrictions on how these technologies can be used is hard, doing this on an international level is even harder. "This spear thing is great," one of our more thoughtful early ancestors must have once said, "but I'm concerned that, left unchecked, we could use it to kill the other people in our own tribe." The dirt-crusted humans crouching around the fire gnawing at bones nodded their assent. Good," they grunted. "Don't kill others in our own tribe, good." But our thoughtful early ancestor, a visionary, had an even more enlightened idea. "This isn't just about not killing people in our own tribe. We need to prevent deadly conflict with the other tribes. We have these spears today, but let's get real. How hard is it to make these things? We just sharpened the end of a stick. Once they see what we've figured out, the other tribes are going to make spears just like ours. Then what happens? Maybe they kill us. Why don't we bring together the neighboring tribes now and all agree we'll only use these spears to hunt food in the safest and most environmentally sustainable manner possible and not harm each other? Cue sound of crickets. I've got another idea, a scrawny man in a faded second-hand loincloth chimed in. Let's use our spears to hunt animals and steal all the other tribes' stuff. Then we'll have more food and more stuff. The heads started nodding vigorously. Good idea. Creating regulations across group borders has always been a tall order. It is a decent bet that someone like our sagacious ancestor warned of a looming threat and proposed an international regulatory effort at the start of every technological revolution, and to largely no avail. The industrial age brought tremendous power and wealth that humans used to kill each other at an industrial scale. The internet connected the globe in novel ways, but opened the door to new levels of abuse, manipulation, aggression, and societal control. As Richard Clark and R.P. Eddy write in their important 2017 book Warnings, the Cassandras raising the alarm about not yet realized dangers are often ignored. It's ironic. If someone suggests creating international regulations now for a potential future danger, many will say it's unnecessary and not urgent. But if a system isn't put in place, it can be too late to walk things back when a threat actually appears in the future. Exactly because managing any powerful technology is so difficult, we need to look now at the better examples of how we've dealt with other revolutionary technologies, like atomic energy, on an international level, for ideas about how we might find the right balance between promoting the great benefits of human genetic engineering and minimizing the worst potential dangers. Imagine what would have happened if we'd thrown up our hands in 1945 and said nuclear weapons proliferation was inevitable, so we may as well let it happen. Imagine how much worse things would be if we just accepted the destruction of our environment without fighting to save our planet and find alternative energy sources. Internationally negotiated treaties on the use of chemical and biological weapons have not been enforced perfectly, or in the case of Syria, at all, but they are still far better than the alternative. We build cars that can go almost 800 miles per hour, but collectively choose to impose speed limits that balance people's desire to get where they are going quickly with a societal need for safety. To find the right speed limit for human genetic enhancement, we will need to find a way to harmonize approaches to human genetic engineering around the world before the consequences of communal and national differences tear us apart. We must find a path forward that avoids the unrestricted fantasy of transhumanism and the dehumanizing legacy of eugenics. As a start, we'll need to figure out what we, collectively as a species, do and don't want to restrict. There is nothing inherently wrong with human genetic engineering or enhancement. If our species was made perfectly, we would not have all the glitches in our biological software that cause people to suffer disease, die young, or not realize their potential in any number of areas. Even those who believe in God might still imagine their maker created the cosmos as something more than wallpaper for the human sky and wants us to figure out how to amend our biology to make exploring and inhabiting distant solar systems possible, particularly after our planet becomes uninhabitable. It may end up being that limiting human genetic engineering in a uniform way around the world could become a collective evolutionary disadvantage. For all we know, some natural or man-made disaster, like a deadly virus or nuclear war, is just around the corner that we won't be able to survive with the biology we've evolved to date. It could alternatively be that altering our evolutionary course could make us less diverse and competitive in a world we can't now foresee. But while the argument for pushing genetic technologies forward is a compelling one, not drawing any lines is a recipe for disaster. If the danger of a genetic free-for-all is likely to be conflict within and between societies, we must find the best possible alternative. What our few examples of past success tell us is that smart international regulation must be a key component of our approach. For the past few years, top scientists have been meeting repeatedly to propose a best way forward on human genetic engineering. Some observers have warned that by getting involved at too early a stage, governments might do more harm than good. Others have suggested that self-regulation by the scientific community should be enough for now. Although the scientific community has done an admirable job laying out a prudent path for using genetic technologies wisely, this self-regulatory approach is not enough. The stakes for our species are simply too high to let human genetic engineering go completely unregulated. As tempting as it is for some of us to support letting 100 flowers of different regulatory and non-regulatory approaches bloom, we must strive for some sort of global harmonization around how far we as a species will go evolving ourselves. At its best, global governance balances the complex and often conflicting interests of diverse countries and groups. Just like the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons balanced the needs of nuclear and non-nuclear states, any effective global regulatory structure on human genetic engineering would need to balance the interests of all countries. Those who see the unfettered genetic alteration of their future children as a basic right, and perhaps even an obligation, will need to find at least some common ground with those who see it as an affront to human dignity. Finding this balance is easier said than done. The challenges begin at first principles. Although philosophers have struggled for millennia to define human rights and responsibilities, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, created in the aftermath of the two world wars and Nazi atrocities, provides a common standard for the inherent dignity and equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family. In its first clause, the Declaration states, "All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights." That's where things get complicated. What does the word born mean in this context? Does it apply to an early-stage embryo genetically altered prior to implantation? Changing the word born to conceived not only limits women's reproductive rights, but also means that each of the 1,000 fertilized eggs in a dish derived from a woman's induced stem cells have the same rights as her 10-year-old child. The issues, in other words, are extremely complex. If we were able to reach consensus on the rights being protected and how to protect them, however, a globally harmonized regulatory structure would have a lot of benefits. In addition to reducing the possibility of both conflict and dehumanizing human experimentation, it could also facilitate international cooperation, reduce costs of regulatory compliance, and foster an environment of global collaboration for the common good. With these types of goals in mind, a few, mostly misguided, efforts have been made over recent years to reach some type of international consensus on the way forward. After the UNESCO International Bioethics Committee asserted that the human genome must be preserved as common heritage of humanity, the 1997 UNESCO Declaration on the Human Genome and Human Rights prohibited practices which are contrary to human dignity, such as reproductive cloning of human beings. The same year, the Council of Europe opened for signature its Convention on Human Rights and Dignity with regard to biomedicine, which asserted that interventions aimed at modifying the human genome can only be undertaken for preventive, diagnostic, or therapeutic purposes, and only if its aim is not to introduce any modification in the genome of any descendants. In February 2002, the United Nations Ad Hoc Committee on an International Convention Against the Reproductive Cloning of Human Beings began negotiations intended to lead to a binding treaty. The non-binding General Assembly resolution adopted in March 2005 by a vote of 84 in favor, 34 against, and 37 abstentions, called on members to prohibit all forms of human cloning inasmuch as they are incompatible with human dignity and the protection of human life. A 2015 UNESCO meeting report called for a moratorium on germline modification because, it argued, making heritable changes to the human genome would jeopardize the inherent and therefore equal dignity of all human beings and renew eugenics. At the end of 2015, the Council of Europe committee responsible for reviewing the 1997 convention issued a statement backtracking from the earlier document, referring to the convention's core principles as merely reference points for a future debate. Not only are none of these international agreements and documents legally binding, they don't even represent a global consensus on the way forward. The countries with the most to gain from, the greatest hopes for, and the greatest cultural acceptance of this science and its more aggressive applications mostly didn't sign on because they were reluctant to have their activities limited by others with less skin in the game. Even more importantly, seeking to restrict any modification in the genome of any descendants and thinking of the human genome as a sacred, common heritage of humanity was an overly simplistic approach 2 decades ago when few people then could have imagined the clinical miracles that would later arrive. By licensing in 2018 the first clinics to perform mitochondrial transfer between embryos, the United Kingdom, among the most thoughtfully regulated countries in the world for reproductive technologies, was not a rogue actor defiling the common heritage of humanity, but a medical and humanitarian pioneer. The so-called three-parent babies born from this process are not outlaws, but, like Louise Brown in the 1970s, healthy forerunners of the world to come. With all the new applications in the pipeline for genetically altering ourselves and our future children to eliminate and reduce the risk of disease, avoiding any modification in the genome of any descendants starts looking less like a humanitarian gesture and more like an investment in future danger. Seeking to protect the human genome as a common heritage of humanity, if taken literally, becomes an argument for banning sexual reproduction and requiring people to only reproduce by cloning. Even if Darwin's principles of evolution in humans are hacked, they too will continue to evolve, just by different means. Evolution itself is evolving. But if efforts to create international consensus around human genetic engineering have so far failed, we must still find a way to do better going forward in order to optimize the future of our species. Like the NPT, an international regime on human genetic engineering would have the tough dual role as both an enabler of responsible science applied for the common good and an enforcer of limited restrictions on how far these activities can go. Finding this balance would be incredibly difficult to negotiate. Draw the line too permissively, and the opponents will likely revolt. Draw it too restrictively, and proponents will find an alternate way to get the services they want, using underground clinics, other countries, or extra-national environments like the high seas, or, someday, space. Draw the line down the middle, and any regulation is likely to be too vague to have any real meaning. Fail to establish one global standard for human genetic engineering, and this revolutionary set of technologies will become subsumed in an international genetic arms race. An agreement would need to neither offend the sensibilities of powerful constituencies deeply uncomfortable with the concept of human germline engineering, nor impede the development of new generations of knowledge and its application on which trillions of dollars of commerce, the competitiveness of individuals, companies, and countries, and the well-being of future generations depends. Within these narrow bounds, any standard would need to be extremely permissive, limiting only the most obvious violations of human dignity. Because governments don't always perfectly represent everybody, we would also need to figure out whose interests would be represented in negotiations, how these interests would be organized, what type of enforcement mechanism could possibly be deployed, and how the arrangement could be used to advance the best science rather than impede it. At this stage, probably the only restrictions that could be agreed upon would be a common definition of what constitutes a red line beyond which human genetic engineers should not pass. This would include potential behaviors most everyone would agree are reprehensible, such as dangerous and dehumanizing human experimentation, creating excessive mixtures of human and animal genes, and engineering humans with new and radical types of synthetic traits that challenge human identity. The average fertility clinic or university lab is not remotely considering any of these today, just like few university physics departments and nuclear power stations are also creating nuclear weapons. Because both the underlying science and our cultural acceptance of what new genetic applications seem normal, healthy, and advantageous will change over time, any international standard would need to be extremely flexible and to be renegotiated regularly to accommodate new technological and medical developments. If, against all odds, we as a species succeed in creating this kind of preliminary global regulatory structure, we will still need to figure out how to balance the carrot of enticement and the stick of enforcement. As with the NPT, I can imagine the more advanced countries offering to help bring others into the genetic and biotechnology age in exchange for commitments by the less developed countries to join an international regulatory body and abide by agreed ethical principles. Even if this happens, there will always be a market for some kinds of extra alterations and enhancements banned in most parts of the world. Perhaps aggressive parents decide to give their children dangerous predatory instincts. Perhaps a given country decides to genetically engineer a subclass of its people to be superhuman masters or docile followers or fierce killers at the behest of the state. Perhaps companies will set up extreme genetic enhancement centers in international waters. What will happen then? At a 2005 global summit, heads of state from around the world endorsed the principle that states have a responsibility to protect their citizens, which, when violated through human rights violations and other abuses, shifts to the international community. Although the responsibility to protect is not legally binding, it was used to justify military interventions in places like Iraq, Libya, and Yemen, with mixed results at best. For only the most egregious violations of agreed international norms on genetic engineering, the international community could conceivably fashion an escalating level of pressures, ranging from economic sanctions to military intervention, to change the ways of a given violator. Given the poor track record of many forcible humanitarian interventions, it may seem downright crazy to suggest that countries might someday justifiably intervene militarily to stop a country from genetically engineering its population in some monstrous way that massively violated an internationally agreed ethical red line. From the perspective of today, it probably is crazy. But if we as a species determine that some future alterations of our fellow human are far beyond the pale of acceptability, some ultimate enforcement mechanism might someday be necessary. Given all of these challenges, establishing and enforcing any sort of global restrictions on human genetic enhancement is a very tall order for which we collectively are not close to being ready. Today's mismatch between what the science can and will soon be able to achieve and how poorly people understand and are prepared for it is creating an extremely dangerous public tinderbox that must be addressed, first and foremost, through public education and engagement. A first immediate step in this direction is to help every country develop its own national public education program, bioethics commission, and regulatory framework for human genetic engineering that applies its own traditions, values, and interests. There are many excellent models from around the world for how this can be done. The United Kingdom's Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority is probably the world's best example of a government regulatory body thoughtfully overseeing advanced reproductive technologies. Different countries can have different models, but every country should have something. When they do, they'll be better able to share engagement and regulatory models, learn from each other, and together evolve best practices. These UK government efforts have been supplemented by the excellent work of the Private Charities, Private Education Trust, Genetic Alliance UK, and the Wellcome Trust, engaging the British public and developing language supporting a more inclusive public dialogue. The United Kingdom's Nuffield Council on Bioethics in 2018 recommended the creation of an independent, government-funded body to promote public understanding and engagement around issues of genome editing and human reproduction. Denmark also does a great job empowering citizen groups to provide input to elected representatives about genetic engineering and other technological issues. But even the most internationally minded people among us cannot and should not wait for our countries and the international community to act. Each of us must take individual responsibility for ensuring we are educating ourselves about what's coming and bringing as many of our fellow humans as possible into the conversation. We must each play a role in jump-starting a species-wide conversation on the future of human genetic engineering before it's too late. Long before the international community turned against slavery, landmines, and blood diamonds, or embraced anti-corruption, African debt relief, and environmental protection, activists lit a spark that inspired popular movements, which in turn pressured governments in each of these areas. Norms are, in many ways, squishy and difficult to measure. Slavery, for example, was widely accepted in many parts of the world until the anti-slavery movement caught steam in 19th-century England. From a small spark at Cambridge University, the movement grew until British laws were changed, slavery was abolished in the United States and elsewhere, and the idea of slavery became increasingly taboo. Before the idea of anti-slavery was translated into law, it was a general feeling, a growing zeitgeist. Lots of individual conversations, deep thinking, research, soul-searching, dialogues, coalition building, and ultimately fights and even civil wars gave the idea form, like a rolling snowball. Never doubt, the cultural anthropologist Margaret Mead allegedly once said, that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, that is the only thing that ever has. This type of norm-building process is required to help our species articulate and champion our best values to find the right balance on human genetic engineering. We must foster a continual series of local, national, and global conversations that can, over time, congeal into global norms and lay an informed foundation for the decisions we will collectively need to make in the future. We've never conducted a species-wide conversation on our future. But how could we have organized a global dialogue in the 18th century at the advent of the Industrial Revolution when only around 10% of the global population was literate and the primary means of international communication was snail mail that took months to deliver? Even in 1945, at the dawn of the nuclear age, only around 30% of the world's population was literate, and landline telephones were few and far between. Today, about 85% of the global population is literate, two-thirds have their own cell phones, and over half have access to the Internet, and the numbers are growing. With an increasing percentage of the world population connected to the information grid in one way or another, we now have an unprecedented opportunity to come together for a more meaningful collective process than ever before. Given the trajectory of the science and political divisiveness of the issues, the window for constructive dialogue may not stay open long. A species-wide conversation would involve connecting individuals and communities around the world with different backgrounds and perspectives and varying degrees of education in an interconnected web of dialogue. It would link people adamantly opposed to human genetic enhancement, those who may see it as a panacea, and the vast majority of everyone else who has no idea this transformation is already underway. It would highlight the almost unimaginable positive potential of these technologies, but also be honest and straightforward about the potential dangers. One way of structuring this global dialogue would be to establish an international commission of top scientists, thinkers, religious leaders, and others tasked to come up with a discrete number of essential questions about the future of human genetic engineering. These questions might include 1. What can be done to ensure the broadest possible access to the health and well-being benefits of genetic technologies? 2. Should there be limits on the application of genetic technologies to treat or eliminate disease? If so, what should they be? 3. Should people have full access to information about their own and their potential future children's genetic makeup, or should this access be limited? If limited, what should the restrictions be, and why? 4. Should parents be allowed unlimited freedom to select from among their natural embryos during in vitro fertilization? If not, on what basis should limitations be set? Should parents be allowed to select embryos based on non-disease-related traits like height, projected IQ, personality style, etc.? 5. If it is proven safe, should precision gene editing be used to eliminate genetic diseases in adult sex cells and pre-implanted embryos in a manner that would be passed to future generations? 6. Do we need a global framework to help prevent the worst abuses of human genetic engineering? If so, what standards should underpin these efforts? 7. What long-term institutions do we need to foster an inclusive global dialogue on the future of human genetic engineering that optimizes the benefits of these technologies and minimizes potential harms? 8. What more can be done to help ensure the genetic revolution helps enhance all of our humanity, and how can each of us be better engaged in this process? After these issues are framed by the expert commission, easily understood multimedia background materials could be created for each question that could be a foundation for an extensive and ongoing series of dialogues to be held around the world. A global coalition of partner universities, school systems, think tanks, religious organizations, and civil society groups could then organize these dialogues to be held in venues big and small all around the world. Each partner organization could organize its own forums, as well as real and virtual dialogues based on the questions, and report back their findings to the Commission. On an even more democratic level, motivated individuals and any other type of group could be encouraged to self-organize their own conversations based on the same central questions. These hundreds of thousands or even millions of conversations could be held in conference rooms, classrooms, places of worship, kitchens, bus stops, barbershops, town squares, nail salons, union halls, internet chat rooms, village commons, virtual worlds, social media forums, and countless other places where humans connect. Global virtual summits could periodically be held to bring together populations from all of the various dialogues around the world, and a network of talks and content based on the TEDx model could both help make learning and participating interesting, exciting, and accessible, and raise additional core questions needing to be addressed. When this structured and informed global dialogue on the future of human genetic engineering reaches critical mass, an ongoing dialogue mechanism, possibly a new body connected to the United Nations, could be created to help further systematize the process and take it to a next level. This organization could pull together the content from the global conversations, views of experts, and inputs from national, non-governmental, and other communities into an ongoing series of recommendations, constantly churning through the cycle of public and expert engagement. Over time, this type of engaged process could help individuals, societies, states, and the global community writ large better understand the genetic and other scientific revolutions, become more active participants in the decision-making process about our common future, and begin to define limited red lines beyond which we collectively feel our species should not, for the moment at least, go. A species-wide dialogue on the future of human genetic engineering may seem like a drop in the bucket compared to the magnitude of the challenge the genetics revolution will bring. Such a process could even potentially do harm by waking up slumbering neo-Luddites who might forcibly oppose even the most benign and beneficial genetic technologies. But the alternative to getting started with this kind of broad public engagement is worse. If a relatively small number of even well-intentioned specialists unleash a human genetic revolution that touches most everyone else and ultimately alters our species' evolutionary trajectory without informed, meaningful, and early input from others, the backlash against the genetic revolution will overwhelm its monumental potential for good. Humans must and will embrace the genetic revolution, but we will be far better off if we do it together. The genetics revolution will unlock one of the greatest opportunities for advancing human health and well-being in the history of our species. We will demand access to genetic technologies for ourselves and our children as a next step in our perpetual struggle with the cruelty of the natural world, and to realize our greatest aspirations to transcend our limited biology and, someday, our time-limited planet. Figuring out how to deploy genetic technologies in ways that enhance our dignity and respect for each other will require us to draw on the best of our humanist values and double down on our embrace of, respect for, and investment in our diversity, equality, and common humanity. While the genetic engineering technologies are new, the values and philosophies we will need to use them wisely are often very old. Deploying our best values at this transitional moment for our species demands that we all understand what is happening now, what is coming, what's at stake, and the role we each must play in building a technologically enhanced future that works for all of us. Jumpstarting dialogues to develop norms that translate into international best practices and ultimately global regulations will be long and arduous. It all might end up being impossible, but simply trying will bring more people into the processes of determining the future of humanity. We will not be able to stop the genetic enhancement of our species, but we can influence, hopefully for the better, how this transformation plays out. It will be a difficult, painful, and conflict-ridden process, but we have no alternative. We all need to participate. We don't have a moment to lose in getting started. Now that you have listened to this book, you are a critical catalyst of this dialogue. Fellow humans, let us together begin the conversation. This has been a Highbridge production, read by Eric Martin. Copyright 2019 by Jamie Metzl. Published by arrangement with Sourcebooks Incorporated. Recording copyright 2019 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.